Charles E. Roach versus Rondell Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Perkins on behalf of the respondent in the action below, Rondell Anderson, who is the appellant on appeal, appealing the partial grant of habeas relief to a state inmate. The district court improperly granted habeas relief. Sometime after the start of petitioner's trial, petitioner was required to wear shackles. The state courts determined as a factual matter that no juror perceived petitioner to wear the shackles. The district court set aside the standard of deference under Section 2254 and rejected the state court finding and granted relief on the shackling issue in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. As a preliminary matter, the state court analyzed the ineffective assistance of counsel claims under the two-pronged Strickland test.
Did the state court finding indicate that there was no, that the jury was not able to see the shackles?
Yes, Your Honor. The state court determined that no evidence was presented that any juror saw the shackles.
Was there a post-conviction hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, there was.
Was there any evidence developed from the bailiff or someone else about the shackles?
Yes, Your Honor, there are four primary sources for information regarding the shackling. Two witnesses who related to the co-defendant, trial counsel, and the bailiff. The two witnesses...
What did they say?
They said that sitting in the gallery, that they knew that he was in shackles and could see that he was in shackles. The one of them testified that when he testified at trial, he could see that...
Mr. Perkins,
yes.
It really looks, to me at any rate, like everyone dropped the ball on determining whether these shackles were actually visible to the jury. You don't, of course, dispute that he was shackled and that there is no explanation in the record for the need for this extreme measure. Why shouldn't we assume the prejudice is inherent? The Supreme Court seems to think that the practice of shackling, the prejudice of shackling, is inherent. And you seem to think that he needs to prove it. Now we're going from your brief. Can you tell me what cases would support your view that he has to prove prejudice from shackling?
Yes, Your Honor. The line of cases from Strickland that says that the petitioner has the burden of showing prejudice under Strickland, prejudice stemming from the deficient performance. And if I may...
No, she's asking about shackling.
Yes, Your Honor, but...
Specifically shackling.
As a substantive matter, the shackling, whether a petitioner or whether a defendant is shackled inappropriately, comes from... the prejudice arises from the risk that a jury would have considered impermissible factors in reaching their verdict. As a substantive matter, that claim in other contexts, if memory serves, specifically a 2255 case from the circuit, Fountain versus United States, the cite for that is 211 F 3rd 429. As I say that again was an ineffective assistance claim where the prejudice was measured by what other factors came into play in terms of whether the jury would impermissibly view the shackling to a determination of guilt. In that case, it was actually a murder that was committed while Fountain was in prison. So the fact that he was already in prison was already known to the jury through the factual presentation.
Forgive me, because you have so little time. And I think that everyone along every step of this has punted, as I said, about the shackles, whether the shackles were visible. And to be honest, Mr. Perkins, you're punting right now.
Your Honor, in an effort not to punt, I would direct you to the record where there's conflicting evidence.
Exactly.
Exactly. And the state courts made the determination that the jury couldn't see the shackles. In such a situation, the district court inappropriately set aside the standard of deference for that. I mean, the state court determination that there was no prejudice coming from the shackling, in the Strickland sense of the word, was ignored. I mean, to shift this from an analysis under Strickland to an analysis of the substantive claim of whether or not he should have been shackled,
it's not the issue of whether or not he should be shackled. Certainly shackling is permitted under some circumstances. Sure. But the question is, can the district judge take a look at what the evidence that was developed and say the state Supreme Court or for appeals Supreme Court made an error of such magnitude that it would be set aside?
And in this case, there is evidence to support that he, had there been an objection to the shackles, which was the performance, it would have been overruled. There was testimony by the bailiff that the petitioner had been found with a handcuff key, and at one point, separate from that even, when they went to get petitioner from the holding cell, he had used a paperclip to undo the bindings, and that there had been rumors of an escape.
Isn't this post-trial? Aren't these things post the trial?
The
you're talking about his escape, though.
Actually, not, Your Honor. In that the bailiff's testimony referred to him in the holding cell during trial, is my reading of the testimony. Pardon me.
Well, you've read the whole record, of course, and I haven't, but.
In the interest of honesty, Your Honor, I have not read the entire record. However, in the post-conviction record that I have read, the testimony by Mr. Byrd goes through something of the time. It's also worth pointing out that the trial started with petitioner completely unrestrained. No handcuffs, no shackles. Counsel testified that on the second or third day, based on what he framed as rumors, a decision was made to shackle the defendant, or the petitioner in this case. Now,
are you referring to defense counsel now?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial defense counsel stated that the trial started with petitioner completely unrestrained. On the second or third day, something had happened. He did not go into it in his testimony, but that testimony, or that the evidence as to what happened is fleshed out more in Mr. Byrd's testimony. And the inference from counsel's testimony at the post-conviction hearing is that any objection or any attempt to keep him from being shackled would have been fruitless. There, whatever had happened, there was evidence that petitioner would have been shackled. And like I said, some flesh is put on those bones from defense counsel in the testimony of Mr. Byrd.
But you see, that's irrelevant, just as Judge Kaney noted earlier. It isn't the shackling, it's who saw the shackling, who saw the shackles.
Well,
that's our problem.
I don't believe that it's irrelevant, Your Honor, and that had counsel, and this may be what leads to the perception that I'm punting or the different people have punted along the way, had petitioner's trial counsel objected, we would have a full record going into how the jail officials knew that there were rumors of an escape attempt. That we'd have a better record, or we'd have a record of trial.
So now you're saying trial counsel was ineffective?
No, Your Honor, I'm saying he was not ineffective because the objection would have overruled. I'm simply saying that to address the perception of punting,
there should have been an objection, shouldn't there have been?
Not necessarily, not if he knew that the objection was doomed to failure. There's no requirement.
Your theory is that there was sufficient evidence that the judge would have allowed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because there was enough information to necessitate shackling.
Exactly, Your Honor. At the post-conviction hearing, the evidence was produced that would lead a fact finder to say that any objection to the shackles would have been overruled. So, as the courts look at this under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel, the first prong is deficient performance. The hallmark of any allegation of ineffective assistance that counts for deficient performance or failing to make an objection is, would the objection have been sustained?
Well, there's several ways to object. If, as you say, which certainly may be the case, no one would disagree with shackling because of whatever conduct it was. But the second point is of having the shackles not be seen by the jury. And you can make objections in that regard, and apparently they were, at least there was some testimony that the only thing that covered him were his pant legs.
The evidence is beginning in conflict with that.
That was in conflict, right?
Yeah, in affidavit.
Shouldn't we remand for a hearing at the very least if the evidence is in conflict?
No, Your Honor. The state courts looked at
well,
the...
What's wrong with a hearing to determine whether there was an apron covering him or not,
The state court post-conviction relief hearing was the appropriate place to raise this issue. It was the appropriate place to bring out these facts. Petitioner had his day in court for this. He brought out the facts, the best facts that he could, to say that there was no drape and there was no apron. To contradict that, the state also presented evidence. There's an affidavit of the prosecutor that says that a drape or other obstruction was in place. And
is this your procedural default, is ineffective assistance argument by not raising it on direct appeal? Is that what you're doing at this point? I mean, no, it's a nice question.
I know. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, to the extent that petitioner didn't raise this as an effective...
Yeah, but I see two problems with this, and you didn't respond to them in your reply brief, so I hope you'll, you know, give me a chance here. First, his trial counsel participated in his appeal, and trial counsel's not going to call himself ineffective. And if he was ineffective at trial, then I think we can assume, you know, he was no better on appeal. Second, Roche cited Indiana Supreme Court cases at page 19 of the red brief, holding that there is no default of an ineffective assistance claim when the trial lawyer participates in the appeal. And if those problems weren't enough, the Indiana courts addressed this claim on the merits. So how are you harmed by this claim being raised here?
Well, I stand by the procedural default argument. Part of the reason we did go into the merits argument in terms of this ineffective assistance claim is that the state Supreme Court did address this on its merits and specifically set aside whether or not the claim had been waived. I believe the language is, while offering no opinion as to whether or not the post-conviction court properly found it waived.
Well, do you contest that there's no default of an ineffective assistance claim when the trial lawyer participates in the appeal?
The problem here is, Your Honor, I would not necessarily concede that in the context of this case, in that at the time of petitioner's trial, the Indiana State Supreme Court was in a state of flux about whether or not allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel claims when should be raised in direct appeal or post-conviction relief. That has since been remedied. The important thing to note, the determining factor in this case at that time was that on the direct appeal, within the direct appeal record, trial counsel expressed his desire not to have the jury see the petitioner in shackles, specifically when the petitioner was getting up to testify. Trial counsel was diligent in making sure the jury could not see the shackles. So that goes to the fact that there had not yet been an opportunity for the jury to see the shackles. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to be concerned about it while he was testifying. So in the context of whether or not that procedurally defaulted or whether that waived under Indiana law the ineffective assistance claim on direct appeal, because
well, I mean,
it was
there are all sorts of reasons not to worry about it, possibly. I mean, I'd be conjecturing the same way everyone else has conjectured if I started to go through the reasons of why maybe if you get, you know, one fast glimpse or, you know, here, maybe the witness stand is right next to the judge, and it looks as if they're afraid he's going to attack the judge. I mean, they're all, that's why we don't conjecture, or we try not to conjecture. And if the law of Indiana was in flux, who gets the benefit of that now?
Well, Your Honor, for purposes of analyzing the Strickland issue, or the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, the state court reached it on its merits, decided on its merits, and therefore made whatever procedural default argument I may have had significantly more difficult to make. I see that I'm getting into my rebuttal.
But before you do, let me just ask you one quick question.
Certainly.
Do you have any idea of where in the record we will find evidence that he was disruptive or dangerous and that the shackles were necessary? Because that would help us.
He was not disruptive in court, at least not in my reading of the record. In the post-conviction record, I have it as pages 1929 is where Mr. Byrd's testimony begins, and specifically...
What page is that?
1929. All right. Then on page 1932, Mr. Byrd, that is, the bailiff, testifies that they had taken a handcuff key away from him in the jail, and the judge questioned if we still all had ours. And then while he was in a holding cell, an inmate informed the bailiff, Steve Summers, that he had some type of key or wire and removed the shackles and cuffs while he was being held in there.
So he removed them himself?
He did indeed, Your Honor.
Is that in your brief somewhere? Because I sure missed it.
I would have to go look. Your Honor,
I'll waste your time now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Clement was a trial judge?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then it was a different judge on the post-conviction?
I believe it was Judge Letzinger post-conviction, but I...
Conroy.
Conroy, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Judge Clement was the trial judge.
It was a different judge, Your Honor.
Mr. Perkins, you agree that the district court's remedy of ordering life without parole was incorrect. If we should find a constitutional violation, what does the government believe is the appropriate remedy here?
Well, Your Honor, it depends upon how the court reaches the constitutional error, in that, theoretically speaking, there's nothing wrong with if the shackling prejudiced defendant in the penalty phase with ordering a new sentencing hearing. But the court could not impose a sentence upon the petitioner.
No,
likewise, if the shackling so infested the entire trial, a new trial would be in order. However, along those lines, I would point out that the State Supreme Court on direct appeal pointed to the overwhelming evidence of guilt showed the petitioner was guilty, so that I would urge the court not to take that route, in that if there was error in the shackling or some constitutional error, it would most likely go to the sentencing rather than the entire trial. Thank you. I reserve whatever time I may have left.
Good morning. I'm Marie Donnelly on behalf of Mr. Roche. Mr. Roche's trial was unfair, and the result here is unreliable because he was shackled during his capital trial and his co-defendant was not. It's our position that by subjecting him to this inherently prejudicial process without any justification on the record at the time and without any showing that some other measure could have, even if there was some justification, could have done this without prejudicing him, that warrants granting the writ here, that he was subjected to an inherently prejudicial process. But it's also our position that there is sufficient evidence on the record here to determine that these shackles and the handcuffs that were later placed on him were in plain view of the jury throughout his capital trial. I think you can look at the duration of the proceedings. This was not a one-day affair. This is a capital trial. It went over a period of 10 days just by the time we went through the sentencing proceeding.
Is it your contention that you cannot, under any circumstances, have a man shackled or handcuffed, even if he is a danger to escape?
Absolutely not.
During trial?
During trial, if there...
How was the trial?
Well, I think first of all, I think that if you show that there's an escape risk, the first thing that you do is, and I think that's a big if in this case. I do not think that.
No, I'm not talking about that. Okay. I just ask you, is that your assumption that you can never shackle or handcuff a person?
I think what you would do is, first of all, is you would look to see, is there some other way to protect security? For example, by placing additional security in the courtroom, like in Holbrook, for example, they did that. To prevent having to shackle the person. You could also, for example, and I believe I've said in some examples in my brief, make sure that he's not wearing handcuffs because that's more visible than shackles. You could put an obstruction around the defendant and make sure that he's not singled out, particularly in a case where like this one, where he's tried with a co-defendant, and you make sure that he's not singled out. So there are things that you could do to prevent that. And I do not think the record shows that they were done in those cases.
We agree with that part, but you seem to be arguing that they can't ever be shackled.
No, I'm sorry.
If
I said that, I apologize.
Okay.
I did not mean that. I also think that because Mr. Roche was seated, and this is on the post-conviction evidence, directly across from the jury for a long period of time, and that other witnesses testified that they could see the shackles, that they noticed the shackles. An individual noticed it from the witness stand. An individual noticed it from the gallery. These were two separate witnesses. They were subject to cross-examination. They were both quite emphatic that there was not any obstruction and that they noticed this. They also noticed the handcuffs.
How do you attack, then, the Indiana court's determination that it was not a problem?
Shackles. Indiana Supreme Court.
Their determination that...
It wasn't a problem.
Well, I think their determination that it wasn't a problem was based on two things. One was that they said that trial counsel made an effort to prevent it. But I think what trial counsel made an effort to do was prevent it that when Roche had to get up and testify, and where, I mean, it was obvious if he was walking to the jury in shackles, that would be noticed, that he asked that the jury be removed when he went up and removed when he came back. But that doesn't account for the rest of the trial. He also did nothing to prevent Roche from being shackled in the first place, as the district court pointed out. And I think, so I don't think that fact alone answers the question here. And I think that they're finding that there was no evidence from which we could determine that the jury saw the shackles was just clearly wrong.
The record seems to indicate that at the time of the state post-conviction proceedings, two of the jurors were interviewed, but no evidence was introduced about what the jurors saw. What should we take from that?
What happened, and I believe this was clear on the record, was that we were, or the post-conviction court ordered, that jurors could not be contacted directly. They had to be contacted by a letter that advised them that they did not have to talk to us. We were able to, under those very strict procedures, only interview two individuals. And if either had a clear recollection, obviously we would have presented the testimony. But I don't think from that you can infer that the jurors didn't see this. I think courts are able to assess prejudice in this and other circumstances without hearing directly from the jurors.
So
I wish we had them. But
are you saying that those that you did interview inferred to you that they could see it? Or are you
saying no, I'm saying
you can't and you cannot make any finding on what they said.
Any finding based on it, that they did or did not.
Well, let me get back to the Indiana Supreme Court. If you say it's just they just made it was clearly wrong, then can the federal court say that's what the situation was and we're going to say there was a harm in that? In other words, can the district court do what it did?
I think absolutely. I think that if the finding, if what this Indiana Supreme Court said is not fairly supported by the record, and if what they have done is unreasonable in light of the Supreme Court precedent, then the district court can absolutely do what it did. Now, I don't think that, we also agree with the state that the remedy is not appropriate, but I think the court can certainly grant relief.
The basic issue of whether or not there was a problem with the shackling being exposed to the jury.
I think they absolutely, the district court was appropriate in doing that. I think that with the jury, the evidence, I cannot imagine a circumstance where a trial of this duration, the way the courtroom was set up under the evidence in this case, that you could not assume that the jury was going to see this. And I think that
The state court judge who heard the case, tried the case, was not the judge on post-conviction relief, was he?
That tried the case? No, they were different. It was Judge Conroy on post-conviction and Judge Clement, as you mentioned. And actually, the proceedings were all conducted before a magistrate. And he's the one that saw the courtroom and heard the evidence. And he made no findings from which... I recognize that is a problem.
Let me ask you something. If the leg restraints were visible to the jury, then why did the defense counsel ask that Roach be permitted to take the stand in the absence of the jury?
I don't think we can infer because he did what I think is a very obvious thing to do in that case. I mean, Roche could have tripped on the way in the shackles. It would have been very difficult for him to get there. That he necessarily was attentive throughout the rest of this. I mean,
and
I think.
In other words, you're agreeing that they couldn't see it during the trial.
I'm agreeing they couldn't see it when he was in the witness box.
Right. Nor when he was at the table.
No, I do not agree that
he
couldn't.
But I'm asking you, if his counsel asked that he be escorted to the witness stand in the absence of the jury. Isn't it a logical assumption that they had not seen that he had restraints on him before? Or why would he have asked it?
I don't think it's a logical assumption. I think that he asked it because it was an obvious thing to do under that circumstance. But I think...
Why?
Why? Because when you are wearing shackles, there were a leg chain, and it's difficult to walk. And it would have been bringing it right to their attention. But I don't think that we can assume that counsel was paying attention throughout this trial. I think it's the district court observed, for example, this is a lawyer that did not attend any of the pretrial depositions, did not attend any pretrial hearings.
That's nothing to do with what went on at the trial. We're talking about what went on at the trial when there is testimony that he was covered with a cape, the table was. I know there are two sides to it.
There was an affidavit, not testimony, an affidavit from the prosecutor about the drape. And I also wanted to clarify, as long as you brought that up, that the bailiff was in charge of setting up the courtroom said that he would have remembered that and that he had no recollection of that. And the other two witnesses, who were subject to a great deal of cross-examination by the state, Patricia Indrasko and Paula Nixitz, said they were absolutely unequivocal that there was no drape. And they were subjected to cross-examination on that point. So I think that the evidence is weighs heavily that there was no drape. I also think that it is the prejudice in this case to Mr. Roche, that was the other point that the Indiana Supreme Court relied on, is I think that not only is shackling inherently prejudicial throughout the trial, but I think it's abundantly clear in this case where Mr. Roche got a death sentence and his co-defendant, who was not shackled throughout these proceedings, did not.
Well, what's that got to do? He's the one who did the shooting. And that's the evidence, isn't it?
No, that's not the evidence.
What is the evidence?
They were both convicted of the same offense.
I understand. They're both convicted of first-degree murder.
And there were three weapons used.
Right.
Three defendants.
Right.
And the evidence was the state tried to assert that Mr. Roche used a particular gun that would have been fired into both victims. So it would have been Mr. Roche was more culpable because he fired this .38 Derringer into both victims, and the state's evidence could only establish that particular gun had been fired into both, whereas the other ones, we could only establish that one weapon was used on one and one on the other. But when you're assessing prejudice, I think it's important to look at all of the errors of counsel. Mr. Roche's...
We're talking now about the shooting. This is the death.
Mr. Roche's father admitted to using the .38 Derringer and firing it into one victim. And that evidence, that he admitted it to someone named Ben Cherry, he was deposed by the state, that was provided to defense counsel, and defense counsel didn't use it. So I don't think that if the court had that information, they could distinguish in any way between Mr. Roche, Mr. Nixitz, and Roche Sr. in this case. I mean, if another person has admitted to firing the .38 into one victim, I don't see how you could infer that Mr. Roche did it as easily as they could have in this case.
Okay.
And I also wanted to point out that the jury was hung.
What, The fact that Nikesh had used the murder weapon in an attempted murder 3 days before these murders, fact was kept from the jury because of the severance problem. How do you...
Yes, and that's another thing that would have lessened the likelihood that they would have found Roche more culpable. That gun, the only distinguishing factor was that they were saying Roche used that gun.
Somebody else 3 days earlier? Because somebody else tried to kill somebody else 3 days?
Because Nixitch, the co-defendant, had used it.
The other co-defendant.
Right.
He tried to kill somebody else 3 days earlier, so therefore it's logical to assume that he participated here too.
That he was using that gun.
Yeah, okay.
He was used that same weapon as well.
I don't know where that's coming from.
And so the 38 was linked with Nixitch, but the jury did not get to hear that. The 38 was linked with Roche's father, but the jury didn't get to hear that.
Tell me this, is there any evidence in this record to support the trial court's decision from your reading of it, that the decision to use the restraints because of the defendant's prior violent behavior or prior escape attempts?
No prior violent behavior is on the record in this case. There's nothing on the record.
No reference to it.
No prior escape attempts. There is a reference that the state has brought out that the bailiff testified during post-conviction proceedings. This was not on the record at the time of trial. There are rumors. Right.
No, but it's just rumors, or is there...
Trial counsel described them as rumors. The bailiff said he testified based on hearsay, which we objected to. So I think that there was never an evidence, a finding of he's tried to steal a handcuff.
I didn't see a finding. Is there evidence of it?
The bailiff said that there was.
Oh, well, that's...
The bailiff said he had heard that was what was occurring, that he had tried to steal a handcuff key. But I don't think that...
And is that why he said that they handcuffed him in fact?
I don't think it's clear, but it's not clear who made the decision to handcuff him. I mean, the judge was supposed to be the one...
I haven't seen the record, that's what I'm asking you.
Okay. I think it's not clear from... I don't think that testimony alone was sufficient to say that this is why the trial court decided to shackle him. I mean, I think there is information about that, but I also think that even if he was that it was decided he would be shackled because of this handcuff key, I think that there were certainly other measures that could have been taken, less drastic than shackling, to protect security in this case. The last point I wanted to make, that this was a very close case, and that there are the jury, in spite of the fact that he was shackled, and in spite of the fact that he was shackled with a co-defendant who was not, still did not recommend death and for Mr. Roche. And also that when the court is considering the prejudice in this case, we have given alternative grounds, and certainly counsel did not, for example, make the attempt to sever Mr. Roche, even though he would be tried in a capital case with a co-defendant, one shackled, one not. And he also did not conduct a reasonable investigation and present all available mitigating evidence.
Well, he didn't know at the time to make the motion for severance he was going to be shackled, though, did he?
A motion for severance can be made at any time under the law.
Under the law, but in practicality, in the middle of the trial, severance is a little bit...
Actually, in this particular case, during pretrial proceedings, when Nixitch was moving for severance, the trial court said, because Nixitch was very concerned and wanted a different trial, and the trial court specifically advised that if anything came up in this trial that would change, anything that looked like there was going to be a prejudice between the two, that he would sever it immediately.
That's prejudice between the two. My point is that they weren't aware there was going to be shackling until after the trial was midway at a midpoint.
As best as we can tell from this record.
So,
there was
you can't use shackling as a reason for severance.
I think that in a capital case where that could have been a reason, that when you have a co-defendant who's not shackled, that's a very dangerous situation for the jury to be able to compare the two and make a single
shot worth it. Shackle one who was, you want to shackle someone who might not jump, but you are sure the other person is, so you shouldn't shackle him.
Actually, what I think they should have done is increase courtroom security, and that way it wouldn't have been an issue.
That's not what you argued.
Well, that's really not a, because there are objections then made if you have more marshals or more court security around, then defense counsel object to that. So it's really you tried to do the best as far as security you can. Just increasing security, it also makes them more likely that they're guilty. I mean, so you have all these.
Well, not according to the Supreme Court in Holbrook, it's not as prejudicial to increase courtroom security.
Six officers in the courtroom.
Not if they're not wearing a uniform.
If they're standing around like this.
Well, I can guarantee you that defense counsel will make objection if you increase the number of security in the courtroom.
Well, I can see that they, although apparently Mr. Roche's counsel would not have at least have made it.
But it's just levels of shackling is a level much higher than just increasing security.
Yes.
Is the record going to tell us why the trial judge severed Roche Sr. from Roche Jr., but did not sever Nixich?
Good question.
There was a separate hearing on Roche Sr.'s severance. And Roche Sr. did move for severance, but to the best of my recollection, and I believe that the state was not contesting it to the degree, and I would assume since they were not seeking death was the main reason. They were not seeking death against Roche Sr., and that would have been very prejudicial for him to have been tried with individuals where they were seeking the death penalty, the other two.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that last point, I believe that that was the reason that the death penalty was not sought in Roche Sr.'s instance, and I believe that is why the trial judge severed his case from the other two. Going to the relative culpability of Petitioner and Mr. Nixich, Petitioner himself testified that he shot both victims, although he claimed he did so in self-defense. He testified that he owned the .38 Derringer and admitted that he told two deputy wardens that he volunteered to kill the victim who owed Nixich money. That is Petitioner's own testimony that he killed him. To the jury.
That's what I thought. So, that's why I asked you if there was anything on the record.
So there is considerable evidence of the difference in culpability between Nixich and Roche. There's no question that Nixich was also responsible, but it is also true that whoever brought the .38 Derringer is less important than who shot the victims. Also, with respect to the juror interviews, I believe the inference can be drawn that if the jurors were able to see the shackles and knew the shackles, that they would have testified, because that would have made this a clear case. It would have put beyond any doubt that the jurors saw it. And because it was not done, I think it is an appropriate inference to say that they could not testify that way. And finally, I'd like to call the court's attention to the 2254D standard of deference that the district court owed the state court's determination. And that is that the petitioner was required to show clearly and convincingly that the facts were different from what the state court adjudicated them to be. And it's our position that he did not meet that standard. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We will take the case under advisement. Thank you for all your help. The court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:38.